Welcome to the top.
1%. Oh, yeah.
1% of show. I'm Paul Salamanca.
And I'm Tom Bocard. Thanks for joining us today to learn how some of the top 1% CEOs, sales leaders, coaches, athletes, and other professionals have overcame adversity and built their top 1%er mindset.
That's right. And this show is live, 6 p.m. Eastern every Thursday. If you want to see one of these shows live, you could go to our home base, which is top1percenter.com. You could also see links to previous episodes there or download the show where all podcasts are available. So, Tom, let's get into this next guest, this next show. I'm looking forward to it.
Take it from the top, man, 1%. Take it from the top, man, 1%. Take it from the top, man, 1%.
All right, welcome to The Top. I'm your host, Paul Salamanca, along with Tom Bocard, co-founders of the Top 1%er Academy, the first ever sales coaching at scale company where we combine SaaS with coaching services for high growth companies and sales professionals. Designed to transform average salespeople into top performing sales teams in their respective industries, and we have proven over and over again that with the right mindset, dedication, combined with our top sales methodology, anyone can make it to the top 1% in sales. But don't take my word for it. Let's quickly hear from some of our graduates who have made it to the top 1% of their sales leaderboard within 6 months of graduating from the Top Academy.
I was 200% to quota last month.
Top rep in North America month two.
Well, I got promoted. So that, and I think the Academy definitely helped with that.
Because I just hit back-to-back months, which nobody on our team's done.
Our sales in the last month have really increased or doubled since January.
Well, I am honestly pretty confident in saying that I am the best AE on my team.
It's the way to be. You gotta be a top 1%er. You gotta seek out the best in everything you do. You gotta have the confidence and you gotta learn the skill sets to do it.
And that was just a few of many great results. But as you know, we have a show to get to, so let's get started. I am really, really excited for our special guest today, Paul Rosen, Chief Revenue Officer of ShipBob. ShipBob is a tech fulfillment company specializing in supply chain and fulfillment, a company that did well over $500 million in revenue last year in 2023. And Paul started when the company was only at $20 million, right? So he's no stranger to high growth and scaling at a very rapid rate. Paul was previously the chief sales officer at OnDeck, and he took that company from $10 million to $400 million in 6 years, and then eventually took it public to the New York Stock Exchange. So I am very excited to hear what kind of magic touch Paul has, because that has been incredible run. So Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Paul, thank you so much for having me. I'm humbled and appreciative to be part of this. So thanks for having me today.
So your background, really, really impressive. I mean, maybe you talk to some CROs and chief sales leaders that, can get one or two of these really special high growth companies under their belt, but you're doing these back to back to back. And I know I mentioned OnDeck, you started when the business was 10 million, you had 10 sales people. And by the end of your role, you had grown to over 200 salespeople, over $400 million in revenue, and you took it public. Just in that one example alone, at that one company, what was the biggest turning point for you?
So I think a lot of it, and this has been consistent with most of the journeys that I've been on, there usually isn't one big client or one big event or one big silver bullet. It's usually continuous improvement and getting a little bit better every single day and every single week. So I think at OnDeck, one of the things that we did really well, especially early on, is that I think every single department cross-functionally was very focused on the customer and meeting customer needs and growing. So I think between having the ability to scale a sales team and working with cross-functionally a group of people that were all very much aligned to the goals and missions of the company, and through continuous improvement and continuing to tweak, making the process easier for salespeople, figuring out a couple ways to drive in more leads, tweaking the process a little bit, figuring out how to have the right salespeople work on the right leads, all kind of helped through the growth. And, you know, to get from 10 million to 400 million, again, wasn't one big lever. It was just a accumulation of a lot of individual improvements that compounded over a period of time.
I'm sure it's gradual, but you also had to work very quickly, rapid growth. You had to pivot a couple of different times, I'm sure, but keep everyone on the same page. So before OnDeck, what was the biggest revenue number that you were responsible for?
Gosh, before OnDeck, it was 40 million. So definitely a big jump.
So 40 million, that's still a good number. So you went down to 10 million to get the job at OnDeck, which is a risk, right? Going to a company that has 10 million in revenue, that's a risk for someone with your resume and pedigree. Did you ever feel like, and that's very unusual, Paul, because usually when you outpace your success, they're looking for, the board is looking to bring someone else in there to go from 25 to 50, 50 to 100. How were you able to stay in the seat from 10 to 400?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. You're right. Like usually as a company levels up, you know, there's different appropriate sales leaders or revenue leaders as the company scales. And I think part of it was just having a very open and candid relationship with our CEO, Noah Breslow, who's a phenomenal guy and leader. And I think part of it is just working with a very high level of transparency and integrity. And in really the last two or three opportunities I've been at, I've kind of taken the mindset that whether it's true or not, I've always worked with a level of urgency that I'm one quarter away from losing my job. Now, the reality is that after you've built some credibility with your CEO, the exec team, and the board, you know, you don't have to be perfect. You can make mistakes. You can fumble the ball a little bit and still recover. But I think as long as you're open, honest, transparent, and, you know, work with a heightened sense of urgency. And, you know, I think one of the things is I've always had a little bit of a level of imposter syndrome. And because of that, I've always worked really, really hard and worked on continuous improvement and improving myself. And I've never had that feeling like I've gotten there or I've arrived. So I think I've always been really hungry. So I think that's probably helped me along the way a little bit as well.
So I love that answer. And you had to grow, I'm sure, personally. Talk about continuous improvement. You had to improve in order to run a business because 40 million to 100 million is a big difference. 100 million to 200 million is a big difference. How were you getting that sort of expertise? Were you looking for external counsel? Do you have a good mentor from your CEO internally? Because a lot of sales jobs, as you know, sales leaders, very lonely job, similar to a CEO. You don't really have too many people to talk to.
Yeah, we had a great CEO with Noah. He was a fantastic mentor. And I think what it all boils down to is, are you hiring the right people and putting them in the right seats? And I think as a leader, you have to think through which positions you hire internally and promote internally, and which do you hire externally? And I think both can make sense in the right situation. So I think where I was probably fortunate, or maybe use a better term, lucky, is I was able to hire the right people and promote them. And where I was fortunate was some of the early hires that I had at OnDeck in 2011 and 2012, where I hired them more at manager levels as we grew and we needed directors and then eventually needed vice presidents. Those team members were able to grow as the company grew. So as we got bigger, I didn't have to disrupt the chemistry or the culture by hiring a lot externally. Yep. The group that I hired early on was able to step up and continue to grow.
That's excellent. I mean, that's an ideal scenario where they're giving you faith. They're giving you a longer leash to see what you could do. That's unique. And then you're doing the same thing to your sales leaders that you brought on board to see how much they can grow, how much they can handle. What do you think was the biggest obstacle growing that quickly within 6 years?
I think every time that you step up, like when you're a director, when you're a manager and managing individual contributors, and then you're a director and you're managing managers, and then when you're a vice president, you're managing directors, how you work with your team is different. You know, how you manage an individual contributor is wildly different than how you manage a director. So I think those were steps that we had to kind of figure out. You know, in some ways we did well, in other ways we had some missteps. But I think like anything else in life, like you make mistakes, and as long as you can admit to making mistakes and not making the same mistakes over and over again, you know, you can continue to grow. One of the challenges in a business like business lending, and at OnDeck, we were the first online B2B business lender, you're dealing with credit. So having different credit contractions and expansions and kind of going back and forth, you know, was always a little bit disruptive. So just in terms of kind of managing the morale and temperament of the team, that was always something that we kind of had to work through and was always a challenge.
Great. And then speaking of a challenge, you wanted a challenge, I guess, going back to a company that was $20 million in revenue. But you and I talked before the show, it's very similar. When I was on the market, I would ideally look for a company that already had product market fit, where, you know, all I have to do, not all I have to do, but I don't have to worry about whether or not this product is a viable product in the market. I could focus on executing, scaling, and growing the business, growing the team. But still at $20 million, that's kind of a risk. Did you feel like you had product market fit at ShipBob?
Absolutely. And when I interviewed at ShipBob and interviewed with Dhruv, who's the CEO, another fantastic guy and somebody that's been a great mentor, I think what was really important with Dhruv, and at this point I'd been around the block a couple of times, one was the core values of the company. And the four core values were being humble, being mission-driven, being resilient, and being a creative problem solver. And those really resonated well with me. While ShipBob was smaller and only about a $20 million run rate at that point, had really good investors. It was in between the B round and C round. Huge total addressable market, you know, e-commerce businesses. Felt had really good product market fit. And I really liked the people there. So between all of those things, while it was a little bit of a risk at the time with $20 million, you know, I felt that my background and skill set, and hopefully my approach to the business would be a good match and fit. And, you know, 5.5-6 years later, I'm still here. I haven't gotten fired yet, which is a good thing. And, you know, we've been on a pretty good run so far.
Similar model where you hired, I guess, sales leaders a little bit earlier, or directors, and you kind of kept them growing within their role?
Yeah, so similar. Our senior vice president of sales was probably my today, and she's managing a group of about 100 salespeople. She was my first hire, and at that point was just hired to manage a team of 6 or 7 people. When I look at other vice presidents that I have on the team, one came from ShipBob, or I'm sorry, one at ShipBob came from OnDeck. He joined me a couple years into, you know, my journey at ShipBob. One vice president was one of the early employees of the company who's been able to grow and develop. One was an external hire that I probably hired 2.5 years outside of joining ShipBob. And then the global team was primarily, you know, hired within the last 2 to 3 years. So a little bit of a combination between having internal people grow and being able to fill those roles and going externally, whether it was a new market or a new segment. So kind of a combination.
That's great. It sounds like you're the type of leader that gives people the shot to grow into a newer role or a bigger role, which is what most people are looking for, right? They just can't find that type of leader or that company. So that's excellent. Were you using the same playbook or a similar playbook that got you to $400 million at ShipBob?
I would say that some of the characteristics of how I lead are very similar, and the type of culture and energy that I bring to the role were similar, but the playbook was different because On Deck was much more transactional. It was a loan business. Oftentimes, we would one call close a customer. And at On Deck, you know, it was all about making a lot of calls, having a high energy, whereas Fulfillment is a lot more complex. You are very rarely going to, well, you're never going to one call close a large customer. You're dealing with these larger, complex brands that have very specific needs. There's a lot of back and forth. So the go-to-market motion was very different. So the sales process had to be different. But I think the overall culture and values that we tried to bring and instill with the team, I think were comparable.
That's good to know. That's excellent. So very adaptable, kind of similar framework. What would you say is maybe one or two big rocks that you're looking to move this year for your team?
Well, I think it's any leader's job to take obstacles and roadblocks away from your team. And I've always tried to be a servant leader, where the way I look at it is my team doesn't work for me. I work for them. My job is to take bumps in the road away from them. And candidly, I probably didn't do as good enough of a job as I needed to last year. Like in 2023, we had a lot more challenges than we had. I think we've worked really hard to remove some of the obstacles. And while we had a phenomenal growth rate in 2023, especially considering some of the headwinds that we had, and considering how big we were, I felt like I could have done a better job. So towards the end of 2023, we started to look at what are some of the areas we're losing in? Why? What are some of the areas where maybe our conversion rates are lower, or activity or opportunities are lower? And we really started to work through that. And, so far in the beginning of 2024, it's been a good year. So I'm, again, continually trying to improve, and this should be hopefully a really, really strong year for us.
Excellent. So I know it sounds like you made, I know before the show, again, we were talking about a couple of pivots you made in order to grow from 20 million to over a half a billion in revenue. Again, within a short period of time, was it 5 years, 6 years? In order to do that, you can't just keep going down the same path. More than likely, you're going to have to pivot, try new things. What were some of the major pivots that you've made that helped catapult that growth?
Well, in 2020, during the year of COVID, every fulfillment company grew. Like, you didn't need to be a great CRO to grow a fulfillment company. Like, you could have been like Homer Simpson or Peter Griffin and grown a company. But I think our board had very high expectations, and around the middle to end of 2021, the board came to us and said, hey, we still expect significant growth of 50 to 60% per year. And kind of the way we were running the business at that point, it would have been a challenge or a stretch. So we kind of pivoted in four different areas. I think the first was, our DNA and blood, and where we had kind of a core competency and what was in the SMB segment, which are e-commerce brands from like zero to maybe 5, 6, 8 million in revenue. We knew to sustain our growth rates that we would have to play a little bit higher in the mid-market, not necessarily the enterprise space, but in the mid-market space, which is, 10 to maybe 200, 300 million in revenue. So we really needed to develop the muscles to do that, which it's very easy to put that on a spreadsheet, but it's very difficult to execute on. You have to change your sales process. You have to change your product set. You have to change operations, especially in fulfillment. You have to look at pricing a little bit differently. And there were a lot of adjustments that we had to make. But, fortunately, we've been able to make most of them.
So let me stop you right there. That's a great point. So it's one thing to have a plan, to have it on a spreadsheet, to present it. Once it's approved by the CEO, by the board, go for it. It takes time to do that. Did you set the expectation of how much time it should take? How do you set that expectation with your CEO, with the board, that this is not just a switch that's going to happen overnight?
Yeah, and that's a great point, because things don't happen as quickly as you would want. And there's always a lead time. And, you know, our company has a sense of urgency. We were fortunate that we started making some of these tweaks or pivots around like August and September of 2021. So by late Q1 of 2022, probably 6-7 months later, we absolutely accelerated, and we're doing really, really good in you know, some of the other things that we were doing. And again, like one was we moved up market. Two is our brand started pushing us to be more of a global company. So we added go-to-market and operations teams in the UK and EU. We added an operations and go-to-market team in Australia. And then we continue to start to get more aggressive in Canada. So moving up market was pivot one. Going global was pivot two. The other thing is a lot of these COVID brands that came up around 2020, right around 2022, when everyone started to go back to Walmart and CVS and Target, a lot of these brands said, hey, you know, we need to work and get into retail. So we started to develop the muscle for helping our e-commerce customers move into retail. We have a VP or a GM that's focused on the retail B2B segment. So that was the third pivot we made. And then the fourth is our biggest competitor isn't Amazon or one of the companies that we compete with for fulfillment. Our biggest competitor is companies that self-fulfill, that do it themselves. That's still around 60% of the market, probably very similar to the payroll processing industry in the early 1990s. So what we were able to do is we have world-class software, warehouse management software, WMS software, that we've been able to decouple and offer it directly to in-house brands so that in-house brands can work with the same efficiency that our internal warehouses. And that was a big lever for us. So between those four, even though at that point we were a couple hundred million in revenue, we were still able to sustain those significant growth rates.
I love that. I mean, the biggest competitor isn't a true competitor. It's losing to no decision, status quo. So you've turned status quo into a whole new revenue stream that seems to be doing really well.
Yeah, 100%.
Very smart. I love that. That's excellent. So it sounds like you're hitting all the right buttons. You're making all the right moves. You're growing at a crazy rate. I'm sure it wasn't always this smooth, this easy in your career. So if you had to think about one moment in time, even if it's with the existing company, where your back was really against the wall and you were questioning whether or not you were going to make it through, what moment in time would that be?
That's a good question. I think I'll probably give two that were very, very similar with similar outcomes. Because now, you know, I've been at ShipBob 5.5, close to 6 years. So I have a little bit of credibility with the board. But early on, you know, the average shelf life of a sales leader is about 1.5 years. So early on, you know, sales leaders have very, very short ropes, right? So in late 2018, I think probably my second quarter at OnDeck, or I'm sorry, 2011. So in Q4 of 2011, we had a rough quarter. Again, we were in the business of credit and loans, and we made some credit pullbacks like 2 months after I joined the company. So we didn't get the growth that we wanted. So I had to go into a board meeting where we were basically flat quarter over quarter, a small lift, but for all practical purposes, flat. And in a similar situation, at ShipBob, my third quarter in 2019 in Q2, we had a horrendous quarter. And in both situations, we had poor quarters. In both situations, I was fairly new in the position, didn't have a lot of credibility yet with the board.
And but I'd you knew you were doing the right things, though, Paul, right? You knew you were doing the right things, but it's a difference between what you know and the perception of what exactly other people are saying.
Yeah, 100%. And what would have been the easy thing to do was that OnDeck said, hey, we had a contraction in credit policy, so we're not actually flat. We're actually, with the opportunities that we have, we're actually doing better. But one of the things that I've learned early in life is that one of the most important attributes you can have is accountability. And I kind of look at it as extreme accountability by saying, hey, it's on me. Here's where we need to get better versus pointing the fingers. I think while you potentially put yourself out there a little bit by saying, hey, here are all the things we didn't execute well enough on. Here are all the things we're working on to improve. You know, I think you build a lot more credibility over the long term, because somebody that is always throwing other departments or other people under the bus and not taking responsibility and always pointing the finger, you know, generally as a leader, you'll have a lot shorter of a shelf life with companies than a board that knows, hey, this person is responsible, this person's doing the right things, and hey, everyone can have a bad quarter, but do I trust that this person's doing the right things?
I love that. And I'm sure there's an in-between, right? There are not many leaders, I would hope, that would throw other departments under the bus, right? So many would take accountability, but I'm sure there's an in-between person too that would be a little too optimistic. So that would take accountability and quickly shift to the optimism, to the positive side. How much of that are you playing, or are you just strictly staying with the accountability part to say, this is where we need to get better? We've fell flat on our face. Is there a balance between being too optimistic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things is that in most companies I've been a part of, the goals are really, really aggressive. And one of the things you have to kind of think through is every board member, if you're working for a venture-backed tech startup, every board member has a portfolio of lots of other companies. Right. And some of their companies, very few of them, but a couple of them are doing really well. Some of them are doing okay, and some of them are not doing so well. So, you know, if you have very, very aggressive goals and you fall a little bit short, but you're still making progress, I still think you're doing better than the majority. So I think you want to be optimistic. You want to push hard. You want to not be complacent. You want to, you know, never rest on your laurels, but you're 100% right. Sometimes when the goals are really, really high, they become difficult. And if they're too high, that can be demoralizing to the sales team.
Yep.
So you kind of have to find that right balance. And I think that's what happened to us a little bit in 2023, is that we raised, and this was my issue, you know, my fault, is that we raised the quota so high in 2023, it was a little demoralizing to the sales team. So as opposed to the sales team trying to stretch and hit those numbers, it was like, geez, you know, these numbers are so high. So, you know, there's definitely a delicate balance that you kind of have to work through.
I love it. And thanks for sharing that story, because it's one thing to be so early in your tenure at a company and not have a great quarter and a million thoughts going through your mind. This could be your last board presentation, right? So what was going, how did you stay resilient, positive mentally? What was your self-talk like?
I think you can't go when you're struggling, you can't go into panic mode. So some of the things that you think about is, as opposed to just saying, hey, our team needs to work harder and we need to do better, and that top-down messaging is really kind of toxic.
Yeah.
Because the way that you're going to communicate to your vice president, so the way they're going to communicate it to their directors, and all the way down to the individual contributor. So I think you kind of need to look at it as a puzzle, and creative problem solve and figure out, hey, it's instead of just blaming everything on the salespeople, what are the obstacles and roadblocks that are in the way, and how am I as the leader able to kind of tackle those so that we can improve? And while every single new initiative that you do does take time and a lot of energy, I still think you have to work with a heightened sense of urgency as a leader to be able to have a real bias for action to get a lot of stuff done. And we've been fortunate at ChipBob that we have a strong culture to do that. And I'm supported not only by the CEO and board with that. But cross-functionally, when you look at the product team or the operations team or the finance team, and really any of the other departments, everyone is really focused on the customer and growth. We don't have a lot of silos within departments, and I'm in a very fortunate situation to have a lot of great coworkers, you know, throughout other functions in the company to work with.
That's excellent. Great point there. And I know, Paul, we could sit here and talk shop for a long time. I do want to thank you for coming on the Top 1%er show. But if there was one advice you'd give your younger self out there that was looking to become a sales leader for the first time, a chief revenue officer for the first time, what would that be?
Well, I have twin boys that are going to be 24. This is the advice that I give to them. Really, it's two things. One, especially with the Generation Z, that generation really puts a premium on work-life balance. And I think in a lot of ways that's healthy and really, really good. You know, you want to live and you want to have passions outside of work. And I think that that's important. And that's something this generation values a lot more than maybe Generation X did early on. And that's good. But what that means is that if you're going to work limited hours, you have to have the right intensity level during those hours. You can't work 30 hours a week at 60% speed. Like, if you're going to work less hours, you have to have a higher intensity level. And I think that's what, and if you can do that, if you can either work longer hours or work a shorter number of hours and work at a high intensity level, you will differentiate yourself from the majority of the other people that are at a similar level. I would say the second thing that's been kind of a big change, I think, within the whole corporate world over the last 10 years is the value of being humble and having humility. I think most companies, ShipBob being one, are culture first companies. And it's really important that you come in and you're humble and you're willing to take advice and you're willing to take feedback and you're willing to improve and you don't come in as a know-it-all. And, you know, I think companies that can find those types of individuals as they're growing and scaling have a lot easier time doing it.
Amen. I love that. And that is lacking today. Especially with you know, the crazy growth numbers a lot of companies have, it tends to become very cutthroat, which is why it's refreshing to hear your leadership style, how you've grown, proving not once but twice that you can go from 10, 20 million to 400, 500 million in revenue plus with the right model, with still having your leaders grow within the organization, with being humble. So that's great advice. Paul, thanks again for coming on the show. It was really great having you on. And for the millions around the world listening to this, stay tuned for our next guest next week. Take care.
Welcome to the top.
Oh, yeah.
We kill the annual quotas. It's the 1%er show, in case you haven't noticed. We talking cold calling and sales and start with tight rhymes. Round here, we maintaining a 4x pipeline.